This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Eek. On the show today with me are Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, as well as Intan Miranti, learning and behavior consultant. And what we want to discuss today is how parents can survive special needs therapy with their children. So, you know, there's never a dull day when you're a parent, but when you're raising a child with special needs, it's even more so. I mean, every day is a new challenge of learning with your child. And a lot of your days are also spent taking your child for therapy. And that's something that requires a lot of patience and commitment from both parent and child. So we hope to get some tips and guidance from Dr. Rajini as well as from Intan today. How are the both of you doing?
Good, thanks, Shao-Eek. Hope you're well too.
Yes, we're doing very well. How are you, Intan?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
We're very well here. It's been a while since we've had you on. And, you know, the idea of the show came about when Dr. Rajini, I think last month's show, we were talking about how to deal with sort of strong-willed or what you would label stubborn children. And you just made an offhand comment about, well, you know, in cases if kids are going to therapy and if they're acting up for some reason, you know, there are some things that parents can look at. And it just struck me that we do, I think there's an assumption that, yes, therapy is important for children who need it for whatever issues that they are facing. But, you know, I think parents struggle a lot with how to help their children cope with it, how to make sure that special needs therapy will be a success as well. But Dr. Rajini, if you could just lay the groundwork first. When it comes to children with special needs, what is therapy and why is it important?
You know, if you look at the definition of therapy, it's very, very wide. And sometimes I use probably the definition of therapy synonymously with intervention. So, you know, in medical terms, when you talk about therapy, it means there is something that you want to, there's something that you want to improve or to mediate, to make a skill, a child learn a skill, or to improve in terms of their delay in their skills. And hence then we would refer them for intervention or therapy. And this therapy is usually, in the medical sense, this therapy is usually carried out by other professionals who are trained in that particular area. So, you know, if you talk about a speech therapist would work with a child to improve their communication and language skills. Note I say communication and not speech. So that's just as an example. And then you have people like Intan who are behavior consultants who are trained to use a specific form of intervention called ABA therapy, which I'm sure she'll explain later. So in a sense, it's a form of intervention to try and mediate or to improve that child's disability or delay in whatever we're talking about. Now, if you talk to psychiatrists, for example, they may use other specific forms of therapy which they carry out themselves. If you talk to, psychologists, there's so many different types of therapies that they use. Mm-hmm. So it's a very broad term, essentially.
It is. But, you know, does it mean that, there might be a perception that therapy, having to go for therapy means something is wrong with my child or that there's something that my child needs to have fixed? What are the kinds of misconceptions that parents typically have?
Yeah, so parents, quite often when we say we're going to send, you know, I'm going to refer your child for therapy, say, they think that the aim of that is to cure the child. Yeah. I would always say to parents, it is not to cure your child of whatever the condition is, but it's to aid your child, to help that child then develop functional skills to move on so that they can probably function as well as they can in the community they live in, to be able to access things in the community, just like other children or as other children would, as much as possible. So it's not a cure. And I think that's the first misconception, that often parents think that if they go and see a therapist, my child's going to be cured. Even with medication, let's be clear, you know, medication is often not a cure. You know, somebody who has high blood pressure or diabetes, the medication is there to help to control the glucose to prevent that person from getting the complications of diabetes, mm-hmm. but you still have diabetes, mm-hmm. or you still have that high blood pressure. So in the same way, if we say, for example, a child needs to go and see a therapist to work on, like an orthoptist, to work on his eye movements to improve the squint, it's not to cure the squint, but to help that child improve or to maximize their potential, to make sure that their visual disturbance doesn't progress further.
Mm. Intan, you want to talk a little bit about what you do as a learning and behavior consultant?
Sure. So what I do is I will assess a child and determine a set of goals that immediately we will work on. And then a team of therapists who work under my supervision will then implement that a few times a week. And I do follow-up visits or follow-up meetings in order to supervise the implementation of the program and also to check on the child's rate of acquiring these skills that we're setting the goals for, and then tweaking any issues, listening to the parents' feedback, concerns, addressing their concerns as well as my therapist's concerns, as well as to check on how the child is generally taking to the sessions. Are they happy in the sessions? Are they learning at the group rate? Are there any issues and things like that? So I do all of that. And then occasionally, if they're already in a school, I will be liaising with the school personnel in order to sort of tie up the therapy with school goals. So there's a complementary and comprehensive addressing of this child's needs across his environments.
And I know you work specifically with children with autism, Intan. So what is, Dr. Rajini mentioned the ABA program just now. So what is the objective of the ABA program within this context of therapy that we're talking about?
Okay, so ABA is actually more of an approach rather than a program. It's a philosophy, it's an approach, and from that approach comes, were developed certain procedures, certain techniques, certain learning and teaching tools, right, that seem to and has been researched to help a child with autism learn as optimally as they can. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's basically it. It is derived primarily from the understanding that the child has to be motivated and happy in order to be motivated to learn what you want. So the child's motivations and interests are paramount, and just as much as the therapist's goals, in fact, more so, in order for them to learn as speedily as they can.
So it sounds like therapy doesn't have to be at a center, where parents and kids go there, work with the therapist and then leave, you know. Intan, can you talk about the different settings in which kids could undergo therapy?
Okay. So if we look at therapy as learning, every child, whether they have therapy or not, every one of us, we learn in different contexts. We learn in a grocery store. We learn at the dining table, in the kitchen, at bedtime. So my personal approach is that learning happens everywhere. Now, specific to if a child is under my supervision, we look at what at that time makes the most sense for the family, where therapy is most effective, least stressful for the family, and then that's where we try to meet the child as best as we can logistically and, you know, with other schedules that a child may have, such as school. So for some children, the therapy with my team, or the sessions, the learning sessions with my team, would happen in the child's home. And then in some cases, it would happen in a center-based setting. That means not in the home, but another space that has been modified and is fun and appropriate for that child's learning. And in some cases, my students have their sessions with my therapist in their school, in their mainstream school, in a particular room or in their classroom.
Mm. Dr. Rajini, what's your role when it comes to therapy for kids?
Basically, when I see children and their families, firstly is to try and establish a diagnosis as much as possible, and also to look at that child's abilities at that time and how, and also what their weaknesses may be that may be stopping them from achieving good functional skills or adaptive skills. And then working with the parents to say, okay, these are the issues that probably are most important. So, you know, with the parents to decide what it is that's most important that we need to work on first. And in that process, sometimes making parents aware about the importance of, you know, maybe communication as opposed to speech. Yeah. So building on, say, getting the child to communicate in whatever way the child already has, you know, using nonverbal pointing, using actions, using gestures, etc. And working on that. And quite often for kids who have delays or disabilities, this may involve another health professional to try and aid that. And that's the therapist per se. So I guess my role is more in terms of planning with parents, what is it that we need to prioritize in terms of what we need to work on, and then referring on to the professionals who then have to work with the children to carry out the therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And what my, you know, with a lot of the families, I always have a follow-up appointment. Whether you want to come or not, I'm going to schedule in a follow-up. And that follow-up may be a couple of weeks or a couple of months down the line, depending on the family. And if they have started therapy by then, I always tell parents, look, you know, it's okay. You don't need to come for therapy in a place that I work, but somewhere where you can access and you can afford, etc. But all I need is some feedback from the therapists or for you to feedback to me what you think your child has achieved with the goals that you've set with their therapist. And so when they come back to see me, it's again about going through what has improved, what maybe hasn't improved, how we can move on from there, and if necessary, liaising with the therapist. So, you know, I there are some people who I communicate with, and I you know, our communication may not be a written report, but it could be just a WhatsApp message, mm-hmm. or, you know, a brief chat on the phone or an email, just so that there might be some information that therapists sometimes have about the child's skill, or sometimes not even about the child's skill, but maybe about something that I don't know about the family, mm-hmm. That may be a stumbling block in terms of their progress. So I guess that's where I am with that, really.
Right.
And trying to see whether a child can generalize the skill when they're with me, if they've done it with a therapist.
Right. Okay. So within that process, there's a lot as well. There's, you know, finding the right therapist that you're comfortable working with as well. And then how do parents and kids make each therapy session successful? What kind of challenges do they come across, and how to help them deal with that? So we'll get into that when we come back from our break. I'm speaking to Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, as well as Intan Miranti, learning and behavior consultant. If you have any questions, do WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Eek. On the show with me today, Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and also Intan Miranti, learning and behavior consultant. We're hoping to provide a guide for parents on how to survive therapy with their children. If you have any questions, do WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Before the break, Dr. Rajini, you were talking about how, the objective of therapy for children with special needs is really to improve any disability or delay in development that the child is experiencing. And the idea is to help them develop functional skills. But Intan, all that is kind of different from the parent, from the family's perspective, isn't it? What kinds of questions should parents be asking themselves so that they can decide what they really want from therapy?
I think the first thing is to actually voice out the goals that they want to the therapist. Mm-hmm. Because that's the first opportunity for the therapist to know what the parents' priorities are. It's also an opportunity for the therapist to perhaps in some cases help the parents learn that certain goals require other steps or prerequisites. And it's an opportunity for the therapist to help the parents learn a bit more about the different steps towards that goal. So, for instance, I'll give an example. So, if a parent says, I want my child to learn to read, and then I find that the child is 3 years old, it may be, it's a good opportunity for me to help the parents to understand, typically in typical development, how that priority lies compared to other priorities like being able to go to the toilet on her own or his own. Being able to request when they want something, and maybe that goal that the parent has, such as reading, might be further down and further in the future, mm-hmm. and not quite so immediate. So it's a great opportunity to at least get the therapist's point of view about the order of priorities and goals. Mm. If the parents tell the therapist a lot about their child, it helps the therapist at least understand a little bit more about the child. And this helps the therapist who's probably working with a child who may not be able to speak to understand the child's interests. So if the parent says, my child likes bubbles, but does not like Play-Doh, loves the bowling pins, but is really afraid of electronic toys with sounds, it really immediately helps the therapist to edit their goodie bag, the toolkit that they come in, because the last thing we want to do as therapists is to scare the child on the first day by sharing a toy, offering a toy that scares the child inadvertently. So this information is so, so important to us, and we really look to the parents to share that.
So there's no information that's sort of too trivial, actually. Every little bit is gives insight into the child's behavior and needs and challenges.
Oh, I think so.
Right. But also then the role of the therapist, you've sort of worked out what you want to gain from therapy, then there's who you choose as a therapy as well, and their ability to connect with the child as well as with the parents is really central here. Dr. Rajini, what kind of guidelines are there, if at all, for parents to choose the so-called right therapist?
Like I always say, choice is sometimes your own enemy at times. And, in certain countries, you don't have a choice, especially when it's state-funded sort of healthcare service. You go to somebody within your district or within your council boundaries, etc. But of course here parents a lot of therapy services are privately run, because obviously government hospitals are very limited in terms of therapy services, and community-based therapy services, although they are emerging in the government health system, still very scarce. And so private therapists have basically filled in the gap, and probably account for more than 50% of services that are available to children with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And choosing therapists can be difficult. I mean, me as a professional, I tend to sort of keep a list of registered therapists. Now, again, that can be challenging because our Allied Health Act hasn't been passed. Mm-hmm. And there are no sort of legal sort of, how do you put that?
Regulations?
Basically anybody, and anybody can sometimes say that I'm a therapist or I'm a child psychologist or, you know, I'm a psychologist and I know how to work with children sort of thing. So for me, there are associations, for example, the Malaysian Association of Speech and Hearing, there are the Occupational Therapy Association in Malaysia as well. So they are now compiling lists of therapists registered with them, and these are therapists who have bona fide qualifications. And for example, in ABA therapy as well, you know, it's not something that is regulated. But over the years, I have come to know of qualified therapists, having had families who have introduced them to me, mm-hmm. or having met them on a professional platform, talks, etc. So I always give the option to parents. I sometimes know which therapist may suit a child better in terms of maybe personalities, maybe, but quite often I don't direct that. I actually just say to parents, okay, this is a list of the professional that I'm recommending to you. You need to find a therapist whom you can get to, because it's more important that you do consistent intervention. So there's no point traveling 1.5 hours and you only see the therapist maybe once a month, especially in the initial stage when the therapist needs to get to know your child. Of course, there are families who travel out from the Klang Valley and you know, that's difficult. But as much as possible, we try and say access therapy services which are near home or within a reasonable distance so that child doesn't get tired in the travel time. And in some situations like ABA therapy for the younger children, we would actually recommend therapy start at home rather than in a center at the beginning, only because home is a safe environment for toddlers and the very young. And it also it gives the therapist a chance to help with adaptive skills, functional skills at home. Looking after themselves.
All right. And on that note, we do have a question from Cheryl who pointed out exactly what you did, Dr. Rajini. There are many therapy centres run by unqualified practitioners with unrecognised programmes. So you've sort of addressed how the public can ensure the place is run by qualified professionals. But also, Cheryl wants to know where to report if the place, if a member of the public suspects that a centre or therapy program is run by unqualified professionals.
Yeah, and this is a problem I have because when I have contacted like the Malaysian Medical Council or the Ministry of Health, a lot of time people have said, you know, this is beyond our jurisdiction because one, there's no Allied Health Act that is in place right now, mm-hmm. and it's difficult to take legal action against them or whatever. Mm-hmm. We have managed to create awareness through social media.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's funny. Some of these quacks, as I call them, they really know how to disguise themselves mm-hmm. and rebrand themselves and promote themselves again. And it amazes me how people just fall for that. And, you know, my advice to families is really talk to your therapist and say to them, you know, hence why sometimes getting not just recommendations word of mouth, but also trying to see what has this person done in the past and in what capacity, and really, you know, For those professional bodies that have a list, like the ones I mentioned, the occupational therapists and the
speech
therapists, etc., you want to be looking at the professional bodies and seeing whether you can get a recommended list. Just like for doctors, we have a list of a register of specialists. I mean, I hope the Allied Health Act gets through, and then we will also have something like a register then.
It's been years for that act.
I know.
Intan, what about from the specific perspective of autism therapy, and there are lots of different kinds of so-called programs out there as well. How do you advise parents?
Well, initially, if a family is referred to me, right, I will ask them who their doctor recommended. Because my assumption is that they've been given recommendations by the doctor, and tells me also, informs me who the doctors feel is a good fit, right? But besides that, I think that generally, having worked with a few parents, that those who are, who know their child well in terms of the child's abilities and what the child does every day, very plugged in into this. They can be working parents. That's not an issue. I'm not talking about having to be a stay-home parent, but understanding what your child likes and how he shows he's unhappy. I think those are also ways you can assess a particular program your child is in, is through your child's reactions and your gut feeling whether the therapist and the child is a good fit. I think parental instincts are underplayed. Parents give up the power quite a bit to professionals. And I want to bring that back a little bit. Sometimes, yes, all of our instincts are way off. That's you, me, everybody. But more often than not, a parent has said, I don't have a good feel about this. You know, and then they get that feeling squashed down, either by themselves, their own self-talk, and go, oh, no, I think that person is really good. They have a really good place, and they said they're this and that. Or somebody else convinces them, you know, that their instincts are not right. I always say, listen to your instincts. Number two is speak to people. Speak to a combination of trusted professionals, such as people in Dr. Rajini's position. Right? As well as perhaps, you know, other parents in the same position, but perhaps have been further down the road, further along the journey, were a bit able to reflect back and give them some information about that. And I think these are two areas that you can lean on if there is no national register, no reporting a body and things like that. These are other areas you can access to.
All right. We'll go for another quick break. And when we come back, let's get into therapy itself and how we can make it a success for children and parents. I'm speaking to Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, as well as Intan Miranti, learning and behavior consultant. If you have any questions, WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. On the show with me today, Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, as well as Intan Miranti, learning and behavior consultant. We're talking about parents and kids going through special needs therapy, how they can sort of survive that grueling process. I mean, you know, it's rewarding, I think, as well as grueling. And really, the ultimate aim at the end of it is to help children develop functional skills, develop skills that will help them live independent lives and help them deal with whatever disability or delay in development that they are undergoing. If you have any questions, do WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Intan, what are some examples of challenges or difficulties that kids typically face during therapy sessions? Perhaps you can speak from your personal experience.
During the therapy sessions itself?
Yes.
They could come in a little bit tired, a little bit hungry, a little bit sleepy. That's more from a physiological point of view. They could come in perhaps on that day, thinking about something that happened earlier and is hanging on to that thought and be still being upset about it. So those can tend to be, some areas of challenges sometimes. Other things could be that they had expectations and that wasn't met during the session. For instance, perhaps the session before, they had access to bubbles and they just enjoyed it so much. And they came in today and expected the bubbles to be there again and the therapist to bring it out. But perhaps the therapist is working on a little bit of a different program. Perhaps the goal is to teach a little bit of delayed gratification, tolerance to not getting that toy all the time. And that's a mismatch with the child's current expectations. And when they don't have it, just like with all of us, it could be, an upset moment for the child.
Dr. Rajini, how would issues like that impact the session itself?
So like Intan mentioned, sometimes it creates anxiety with the child. And sometimes parents, when they see that their child is crying or upset, they immediately perceive it as, what's my child going to learn if he's upset or crying? And so this is where it's really important that therapists talk to parents and explain to them why the session's being carried out that way. Sometimes, we say we don't really need to forewarn the child, but we need to forewarn the parents. So that the parents understand, we've just been having a team meeting here in our hospital today. And, an example that really that showed it was when an occupational therapist mentioned how she was trying to help a child sort of regulate and listen to instructions and wait before responding, etc. But the mum, although she had tried to explain it to the child, to the parent beforehand, and sort of saying, let's not, don't interrupt, don't prompt him, don't give him the answers. Mm-hmm. The parent's mindset was still, I want my child to succeed in the task. It was sort of searching for alphabets and shapes. And, the therapist sort of scattered it around the room, and the child had to spend time and not get distracted, but everything else. And the parent got frustrated and sort of interrupted and sort of went up to the child and tried to point out, that's the letter A, that's the diamond, or, So this is where we sometimes, and I think, so this is where my role is, I think, sometimes to tell parents, look, the aim is not to teach your child the concrete alphabet, number, writing, etc. The aim right now is to work on your child's behavior, waiting, listening to instructions, and sometimes I have to tell parents, your child may have the academic skills, but if the child doesn't have the behavioral skills, he is still not going to succeed in school. He may still be at risk of, being, not to say expelled, but, that may exacerbate further that child's emotion and, well-being socially in school. So, that's what I see.
I mean, Intan, it must be tempting to sometimes tell parents that they should stay out of the sessions, right? But what would be a parent's role in therapy, especially for younger children who perhaps need the parental figure there with them?
It's specific to children who are younger. Actually, sometimes it is better than they're in, and sometimes it isn't. It really depends on the child as well as the goal we're currently trying to achieve. So if sometimes it's better for the parents to be in a session, then I think that it has to be discussed ahead. For instance, I was just in a meeting where I did mention to parents, why don't you come in and watch for 5 minutes? And really, during these 5 minutes, it would be wonderful if you can just watch how the therapist reacts to the child when he does this or that. It'd be great if you don't respond, and let's just see how it goes. When you give clear instructions, I think it helps a parent understand their roles better.
Mm.
Then if we don't, I think that's one of the things we can do to help parents understand the specific. On another day, though, we might have the same parent come in with the child in the session, but we actually have different goals. We may say something like, today we'd like you to sit in for 5 minutes, but this time we would like you to demonstrate this, and the therapist will give you feedback on it. And that way the parent will know, will be guided on how to do it at other times when the therapist isn't around. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. So there's a lot of communication between the therapist and the parents, and it's got to be constant as well, not just at the beginning of a therapy program, but at each session.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, built into a good program is a consistent and specific time for discussion, for troubleshooting. Most of the time, as much as we can, we like to do it when the child isn't present, because even the youngest child, or even a child who cannot speak, can understand something is being said about them. And typically, we discuss the more disparaging things that are issues. And as much as I would like to keep the child out of earshot at that time, it is not always possible, especially when a parent has no other caregiver. But then we have to speak in code a lot.
Right. Dr. Rajini, what are some other practical factors that parents should consider to make therapy a success? And I think that these may be things that parents aren't thinking about because they're thinking about the bigger goal of helping their kids improve. I know you've mentioned previously in another show about, you know, just make sure they're not hungry. That it's something as simple as that.
Yeah. I mean, we always say, you know, if you're sending a child to school, if you want your child to succeed, you make sure your child is fed and watered. You make sure your child has had enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you make sure that emotionally your child is okay. So, you know, you don't want to start the morning by screaming, shouting, whacking your child, and then you send your child off to school, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way, if you are sending your child, if your child is going to attend a therapy session, you got to make sure all of the above is done as well, okay? Number two, I would say parents sometimes need to keep their expectations realistic.
Mm-hmm.
I know of parents who sometimes, and I've seen it for myself outside my waiting room, where parents are giving their child a little lecture about make sure when you go in with teacher, you behave yourself, you follow what she tells me to do, and then when you come out, mommy will buy you an ice cream.
Oh dear, that sounds familiar.
and you know, for a lot of our kids, very broad, you know, that's too much information, one, and all they hear is the ice cream at the end, and then they start crying because they think, ice cream, it must be coming now, you know. I'm not saying don't, you know, you can treat your child, but, you know, just before that child goes in, trying to bombard them with all these little instructions sometimes can be a bit overwhelming, and you actually then distract the child, and the child thinks, oh, ice cream, ice cream, ice cream. And then when they go into the therapy session, the child will be saying, mommy, ice cream, mommy. So these are little pointers. But I think importantly, parents, when they go for therapy or even before they embark on therapy, I would say don't embark on therapy if you're not ready to make changes in your day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of therapy for me, like I said, is to help a child improve and minimize disability and to improve their functional skills. Once a week therapy or even daily therapy is not going to succeed if that parent is not actively involved.
Mm-hmm.
As Intan says, it doesn't mean that they have to be present all the time. Yes, we would like them to be, but there should be at some point in the therapy session that there is feedback. There are suggestions in terms of what the parent can do at home. And, you know, that there's a review every couple of weeks just to say, okay, what have we achieved? What haven't we achieved? Mm-hmm. So parents need to make time for all these things as well and try and see how they can adapt it within their home setting and generalize it to everyday skills. And this is not just for ABA. This is for, you know, speech therapy. This is for occupational therapy. This is for even if you're seeing a clinical psychologist on how to do, to help your child manage his anger or tantrums, etc. Mm-hmm. And I always say, to be honest, we shouldn't just be calling therapists, but we should be saying to parents, one of your roles is as a therapist as well. You're the home therapist. Mm. And so you play a very big role in that sense.
Intan, let's talk a little bit, just very briefly, about roadblocks, I guess. If parents feel that therapy isn't working out for their child for whatever reason, how do they think about their next course of action?
I think the first thing is to actually speak with the therapist or the consultant on the team and communicate everything. I think that's the first step, because then the therapist has an opportunity to understand the parent's point of view and then respond to it, react to it. In some cases, it does help to guide the program. Mm-hmm. You know, parents' responses are very useful. In other cases, it's an opportunity for the therapist to explain to the parents their point of view about where the child is at that time. There's many instances that the child has made a lot of gains, but they're not apparent, right away. So it's a great opportunity for us to record some bits and show the parents, okay, these are what you missed. So let's balance that against some of the things that you more readily see. For instance, the child does really great in the session, but then comes up crying because perhaps he still wants to play some more with the therapist toys. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't look good, right? The child comes out of session crying. So mm-hmm. it may seem that way. And a lot of times, unless you're in the session, you don't get the flavor of it. So one thing I like to do when a parent comes to me and say, I'm a little troubled, is to find out the details. I share more details with the therapy to create sort of a balanced perspective, perhaps, hopefully, about what we're experiencing in the sessions versus what is perceived from outside the session. Other things would probably be, looking at the child's demeanor themselves. If they're able to communicate well, it's easier than if the child isn't able to communicate well. I don't know your definition of roadblocks per se. If the roadblocks that the parent perceive is child's unhappiness, we have to look at many, many possible reasons. It could be something from a tummy ache that's ongoing, so something to do with physical health, or something environmental in the therapy session, or something that preceded the sessions typically. For example, if the child has iPad all the way to the center and then the iPad is taken away right when therapy session starts, it can lead to a really miserable session because the child is thinking about the iPad the whole time. Mm. So then we speak to the parents about changing certain patterns, perhaps leaving the iPad at home so he can perhaps get over his upset moments in the car. And then when he's out of the car into session, it's a great session. So little things like that, I think.
Yeah, again, very simple things already ingrained into daily habits, but that parents may not necessarily be thinking of as a main point, as contributing to all of that. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but do you have a final message for us, Intan, about, you know, surviving, for parents to survive therapy?
I think that you can do more than survive therapy. I think therapy is wonderful. That's what I think. I think therapy is a great resource for parents. You're having someone help you along the parenting journey. That's great.
And Dr. Rajini?
I agree, Intan. I would say, you know, parents need to start thinking of therapy as something that can help them help their children. Mm-hmm. i.e. they need to learn from therapy more than their children need to learn, and I put that learn in inverted commas, mm-hmm. Than their children, because at the end of the day, they are their child's best therapists. And incorporating therapy into daily life is the best way for a child to progress in the future. And then that means spending time with your kids, just like we were forced to during the MCO. And, you know, I'm sure there was a reason why this whole thing happened. You know, somebody wanted us to have a pause button in our lives and
spend time with our children.
Exactly. Reset our lives. So, you know, think about that. Think about therapy in those terms. And it's not something that you outsource your child to fix your child.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, as well as Intan Miranti, learning and behavior consultant. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.